Hello and welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Well, I just wanted to say thanks for now over 100,000 downloads. This is our 90th episode. It's an honor that so many of you have listened and shared, and please keep on sharing. I wanted to mention Joseph James has a new movie called The Freemason, which has Sean Astin as part of the cast, so he's getting some pretty big names in his movies. I can't wait to see what it's all about. In addition, Templar Nation, his other project, should be hitting the shelves very soon. And a note in last week's episode, Freemasonry in Black and White, a new book by Brother Charles Harper, should be released sometime in March. And if you missed out last week, episode 89, we interviewed the author, Brother Charles Harper, and we had a really nice chat. A reminder to please share the Midnight Freemasons Facebook page with your friends and brothers. We have all original content published 3 times a week on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, sometimes funny, sometimes educational, and other times heartfelt. Just good stuff. You can check out that site either by clicking through our site, wcypodcast.com, or by going directly to www.midnightfreemason.blogspot.com. Again, that's not plural in the web address. And we're so lucky to have the talent that we do have on the Midnight Freemasons, and we're always looking for authors. So if you have something to contribute, get a hold of me through the email link on our website, or you can just email me at wcypodcast@gmail.com. James E. Fry has an amazing set of posts there, which was related to the Lost Word. And he's in the process of recording the third part for the show. We had him read the first and second parts in the last few weeks, and it went very well. In the meantime, I found this short talk bulletin about the Lost Word that I thought you might all enjoy. So without further delay, here it is. The Legend of the Lost Word, a Short Talk Bulletin, Volume 6, May 1928, Number 5, by Unknown. Ancient craft masonry attains its climax in the symbolism of the Lost Word and a quest for its recovery, but in our ritualistic work there is little attempt at explanation. The observation has been made that language is growth. Every word had to be created by man. Back of every word is some want or necessity of mind or body and the genius to make expression in some sign or sound that we call a word. Some words are rough and rugged like the skins of wild beasts, others glitter and glisten like satin and gold. Words have been born of hatred and revenge, of love and sacrifice, of hope and fear, of agony and joy. In them mingle the darkness and the dawn. They are the garments of thought, the robes of reason, the shadows of the past, the reflections of the present, and the crystallization of the human history. It has been said that the egocentric instinct in a man has made self-preservation the first law of nature, that growing out of, or alongside, of it is the gregarious instinct, which has produced social governments and philanthropic enterprises. Deeper than these instincts, there is in man a consciousness, however dim, inexplicable forces and agencies, and an urge to realize their potency. In the childhood of the race, this occasioned the thought of supernatural power in a word. The word that causes the heavens on high to tremble, the word that make the world below to quake, constitute the first 2 lines of Babylonian's hymn inscribed upon the clay tablet 5,000 years ago, in which the wise priesthood of a great religion sang praises to the might and power of a word. Some Masonic writers have held that the Aum, or A-U-M, pronounced Aum, is the oldest omnific name of God in the world, that it came out of India, and that it has also been spelled A-O-M, but pronounced the same way. Frank C. Higgins has written a book on this name as the Lost Word, and claims it is concealed in the terminal letters of the names of the 3 ruffians. To the best of my knowledge, this concealment has not been satisfactorily explained. In my opinion, Freemasonry is largely indebted to the Hebrews for the legend of the Lost Word. Shakespeare says, "What's in a name? The Jew saw in a name a sign, standing for the personality, the achievements, the reputation, the character, the power, and the glory of the one who wore it." Joseph meant increaser. Moses meant drawn out of water. Israel meant Prince of God. And the burning bush, the ineffable name of God Almighty, was communicated to Moses. So overwhelming was its glory that the people pronounced it in whispers. The 3rd commandment of the Decalogue, delivered from Mount Sinai, declared, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." The priestly rule contained in Leviticus reads, He that pronounceth the name of the Lord distinctly shall be put to death. At last only the high priest was permitted to utter the name, and that but once a year, on the Day of Atonement, and in the Holy of Holies its utterance was accompanied by the beating of cymbals and the blowing of trumpets so as to completely extinguish the sound of the human voice. Such were the wrappings of secrecy and sanctity which the Jews threw about the name of God. As they used no vowels in writing, all that was ever seen were four consonants, J-H-V-H, the tetragrammaton, or four-lettered name of God. From the letters, there was no clue to the pronunciation. No one could understand them any more than we could know that M-R stands for Mr. and D-R stands for Doctor, unless someone told us so. According to the tradition, the great catastrophe of the Babylonian captivity was that, through the death of the high priest without a successor, the name was lost. At the end of that captivity, priests and scribes began a search for the lost name, which has continued without avail for 2.5 millenniums. The four consonants they had, but it is doubtful if anyone has been able to supply the sound of the vowels. It is believed that this four-lettered name of God is the lost word of Masonry today. Like everything else in our science, it is a symbol. It is the consummation of all Masonic symbolism because it stands for the divine truth. Brotherly love and relief are but the means to an end. The final design of our institution is its third principal tenet, the imperial truth. In some aspects, truth seems relative because it is not complete, but only partial. Now we see through a glass darkly, but the ultimates of truth are immutable and eternal. The fatherhood of God and the immortality of the soul down to this deep foundation Masonry digs for a basis of its temple and finds an everlasting rock. Dr. Joseph Fort Newton says, Freemasonry makes no argument but presents a picture, the oldest if not the greatest drama in the world, the better to make men feel those truths which no mortal words can utter. It shows us the tragedy of life in its blackest hour, the forces of evil, cunning yet stupid, which come up against the soul, tempting it to treachery, a tragedy which in its simplicity and power makes the heart ache and stand still. Then, out of the thick darkness there arises like a beautiful white star, that in man which is most akin to God, his love of truth, his devotion to duty, his willingness to go down into the night of death, if only virtue may survive, and throb like a pulse of fire in the evening sky. Here is the ultimate and final witness of our divinity and immortality, the sublime death-defying moral heroism of the human soul. Translated into personal terms, it is the Apostle Peter at his execution asking to be crucified head downward. It is the Spartan Leonidas at the pass of Thermopylae with a handful of men holding back the hordes of Persia and spelling out the salvation of the Greek Republic. It is the Swiss Arnold von Winkelried receiving the points of Austrian spears into his own breast and making his dead body a bridge of victory for his countrymen. It is the American Nathan Hale grieving that he had but one life to give, but one supreme sacrifice to make at the altar of our national liberty. It is our operative Grand Master, the Tyrian builder, before the brute forces of death and destruction surrounding his life but preserving his integrity. Brother H.L. Hayward says, "The search for a lost word is not a search for a mere vocable of a few letters which one might write down on a piece of paper. It is the search for truth. It is the quest for the highest possible life in the spiritual unfoldment of humanity. It is the seeking after the name, the power, and the glory of God. The purpose is the same whether the age-old legend of the quest be woven into a tragic tale like Eugene Sue's Wandering Jew, or thrown about a mystic drama like Maurice Maeterlinck's Blue Bird, or crystallize in an epic poem like James Russell Lowell's Vision of the Sir Launfal. Whether it be a missing chord of music, the vacancy of sanctuary, a design left unfinished by the death of the master builder, or the lost word in Masonry to be recovered through patience, perseverance, and time, it always symbolizes a search for something good and beautiful and true. At times of meditation and introspection, there is something vaguely haunting in the legend of the lost word. Like the fleeting fragrance of a forest flower experienced in the past, the murmured music of a rippling brook heard in childhood, the purple sheen of twilight on a distant hilltop, or some exquisite dream of infinite love in the long ago forgotten but trembling at the doorway of memory. This quest is the central thought of Henry Van Dyke's The Other Wise Men, an inspirational story of beauty and charm which tells of the days when Augustus Caesar was the master of many kings and Herod reigned in Jerusalem. Artaban, the Median, The fourth wise man studied the constellations and certain prophecies of Zoroaster, Balaam, and Daniel. Inspired by the appearance of a star in the sky, he sold his possessions and bought 3 gems, a sapphire, a ruby, and a pearl, to bear as a tribute to a newborn king. The other 3 wise men were to wait for him at the ancient temple of the 7 spheres, because he tarried in a palm grove outside the walls of Babylon and ministered to a Parthian Jew in the ravages of a fever. He did not reach the appointed place in time and found a note which said, "We have waited past the midnight hour and can delay no longer. We go to find the king. Follow us across the desert." This meant that Artaban must sell his sapphire to buy camels and provisions for the journey. A ministry of mercy cost him the first jewel. The 3rd day after the wise men had laid at the feet of a child in a manger their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, Artaban entered Bethlehem, weary but full of hope, bearing his ruby and his pearl. The streets were deserted, but from an open door of low stone cottage he heard a woman's voice singing softly. He entered and found a young mother hushing her baby to sleep. She told him of the strangers from the east who had appeared and gone, that the man from Nazareth had taken the babe and its mother and fled away to Egypt. She placed food before him, the plain fare of humble peasants. The baby slumbered, as great peace filled the quiet room, but suddenly there came the noise of wild confusion in the street, the shrieking and wailing of women's voices crying, "The soldiers of Herod, they are killing her children." The mother's face grew white with terror. She huddled for her child in a dark corner of the room. Artaban's form filled the doorway, and looking straight at the captain, he said, "I am alone in this place, and I am waiting to give this jewel to the prudent captain who will leave me in peace." He showed the ruby glistening like a great drop of blood in the palm of his hand. The lines of greed tightened hard around the captain's lips. He took the ruby in his fingers and gave the order, "March on! There is no child here. This house is still." Artaban turned his face to the east and prayed, "God of truth, forgive me. Forgive my sin. I have said that which is not to save the life of a child." The voice of the woman said very gently, "Because thou hast saved the life of my little one, may the Lord bless thee and keep thee. Lift up the light of his countenance upon thee and give thee peace." Thus he parted with his second jewel. Down in Egypt, Artaban found faint traces here and there of the Holy Family. Though he found none to worship, he found many to help. He fed the hungry, clothed the naked, healed the sick, and comforted the captive. His years moved swiftly by. After 33 had gone in his old age, an irresistible impulse came upon him to go again to Jerusalem. He had his pearl and was looking for the king. It was the season of Passover when he reached the city. There was great excitement. Multitudes were being swept by a secret tide toward the Damascus gate. He joined the throng and inquired the cause of the tumult and where they were going. "We are going," they answered, "outside the city walls to a place called Golgotha, where Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, is to be crucified." How strangely the words fell on the tired heart of Artaban. At last he was to see the king, and he still had his pearl, in time perhaps to offer it as ransom. A troop of Macedonian soldiers came down the street dragging a young girl into bondage and slavery for debts of her father who had died. Being of Artaban's country, she recognized the sign of priesthood, the winged circle of gold which he wore. Tearing away from the soldiers and throwing herself at his feet, she prayed, "Have pity upon me. Save me from a faith that is worse than death." Artaban trembled as a conflict entered his soul. It was the old conflict which he had come to in the palm grove, and again in the stone cottage, the conflict between expectations of faith and the impulses of love. In the darkness of his mind, it seemed clear that the inevitable comes from God. He took the pearl from his bosom and placed it in the slave girl's hand, saying, "This is thy ransom. It is the last of my jewels which I kept for the king." As he spoke, the sky darkened, the earth quaked, the houses rocked, a heavy tile shaken from the roof fell and struck the old man on the temple. He lay breathless and pale. As she bent over him, there came a voice through the twilight, small and still, like music sounding from a distance. The old man's lips began to move. She heard him say, "Not so, my lord, for when I saw I thee and hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee to drink. Thirsty in 3 years have I sought thee, but I have never seen thy face, nor ministered to thee, my king." Again the maid heard the sweet voice faintly as from afar, but now it seemed as though she understood the words, "Verily I say unto thee, inasmuch as thou hast done unto one of the least of these my brethren, thou hast done it unto me." At the end of the journey, in the presence of human need,
in the expression of human sympathy, in the rendering of human service, he came face to face with his king and discovered his lost word. He heard a divine voice saying, "Inasmuch and well done, good and faithful servant." The lost word symbolizes the kind of truth that cannot be acquired from reading books, that cannot be obtained by paying so much money and listening to so many college lectures. It symbolizes a truth that must be wrought out through the vicissitudes of life in personal experience. If the word stands for the personality, the attributes, the power, and the glory of God, we must be satisfied with the substitute, because human life and the ages of time are too short for a complete revelation of that high and holy name. The whole design of Masonic science is a quest for truth. Divine truth is symbolized by the logos, the word, the name. Through this symbol, all the other symbols of Masonry guide a man onward and upward to God. Over the hills to a valley of endless years, over roads of woe to a land without a tear. Up from the haunts of men to this place where angels are, this is the march of morality to a wonderful goal afar. So mote it be. So I hope you all like that. Next, I wanted to mention our two podcast partners, in a sense, The Winding Stairs, which is hosted by Brother Juan Sepulveda. It has some delightful and educational values. I love it. It makes me question my actions and think about my inner journey. A truly great show. Also, I am honored to be featured on his show at times. I contribute an exclusive Masonic conspiracy. So if that interests you, please go to iTunes or Stitcher Smart Radio and have a listen. It's great stuff. Also, check out Brother Juan Sepulveda's Masonic fundraiser, which he runs as well. Also, I want to say something about our friend and brother Rob Lewis, who hosts the Far From Centered podcast. He is a Freemason, but his show is not just Masonic. In fact, it's political in nature. And it also has amazing interviews with great guests, from Reiki teachers to military veterans and everything in between. Brother Robert Lewis is also on iTunes. If you guys have a few minutes to find either of those two shows on iTunes and give them a rating. Also, if you remember, go ahead and give this show a rating as well. I want to take a minute and mention a few of the ways to keep this show going. First is our affiliate, Onnit Labs. They make some great supplements, which are all natural and super healthy. In addition, some great fitness equipment as well. Stuff that you would use right at your house. Pull-up bars, kettlebells, battle ropes, jump ropes, just some cool stuff. And if you click through our website at wcypodcast.com and you see the link for Feed Your Brain, that will take you to Onnit Labs. Whatever you buy there, they send a little bit our way, and if you use the promo code WCY at checkout, you'll get 10% off your order as well. Additionally, I know there are several ways of listening to the show for free, and that's cool. I put the show out there for free. But if you want to help support the show, check out the apps for the show, which are available for Apple and Android via our website, and these let you stream the show, but also because you got the app, we can give you back a little something, usually the papers that we read, and a Masonic wallpaper. Finally, if apps aren't your thing and you want to help out, we do have a donation button, which is managed by PayPal, so it's all secure and every penny goes right back into the show. I don't pay myself anything. I have a day job. I work 40 hours a week. Some people think I have a team, but it's just me. Me and all you guys listening and helping out, whether it's a couple bucks here or there, or emails with awesome things that we can use for the show. Several of you have written me emails, and we've answered questions, and we've developed pieces for the show based on your suggestions. So thanks to everyone for all the help. Now I'd like to go into this week's famous Freemason. This Canadian sports coach and innovator, who later garnered an American citizenship, well, he invented the sport of basketball in 1891 and is often credited with introducing the first football helmet. He wrote the original basketball rules, founded the University of Kansas basketball program, and lived to see basketball adopted as an Olympic sport in 1904 and as an official event at the 1936 Summer Olympics in Berlin, as well as the birth of both the National Invitation Tournament in 1938 and the NCAA Men's Division Basketball Championship in 1939. Born in Canada, James Naismith studied physical education in Montreal before moving to the United States, where he developed basketball in late 1891 while teaching at the International YMCA Training School in Springfield, Massachusetts. Naismith also studied medicine in Denver, taking his MD in 1898 before moving to the University of Kansas after a decade serving there as a faculty member and part-time basketball coach during the sport's fledgling years.
He became the Kansas Jayhawks athletic director. He became a U.S. citizen in 1925. James Naismith's contribution to basketball have earned him several posthumous honors, such as the Canadian Basketball Hall of Fame, the Canadian Olympic Hall of Fame, the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame, the Ontario Sports Legend Hall of Fame, the Ottawa Sports Hall of Fame, the McGill University Sports Hall of Fame, the Kansas State Sports Hall of Fame, and the FIBA Hall of Fame. The Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, where he is a member of the original Hall of Fame class, which was named in Naismith's honor. Naismith was also a National Guard chaplain with the 1st Kansas Infantry Regiment. He taught his soldiers basketball to control their excess energy. His effort helped increase morale and even lowered the rate of disciplinary actions among soldiers. On June 20, 1894, Naismith married Maud E. Sherman from Springfield, Mass. The couple had 5 children. He was a member of the Pi Gamma Mu and Sigma Phi Epsilon fraternities, and regarding his spiritual beliefs, Naismith was a Presbyterian minister. He was also remembered as a Freemason. Maud Naismith died in 1937, and on June 11, 1939, he married his second wife, Florence B. Kincaid. Naismith suffered a major brain hemorrhage on November 19th, the same year, and died 9 days later in his home located in Lawrence, Kansas. Naismith was 78 years old. Naismith is buried with his first wife in Memorial Park Cemetery in Lawrence, Kansas. Florence Kincaid died in 1977 at the age of 98 and is buried with her first husband, Dr. Frank B. Kincaid, in Elmswood Cemetery in Beloit, Kansas. James Naismith was initiated in 1894 in Roswell Lee Lodge, Springfield, Mass. And affiliated, he was the worshipful master of Lawrence Lodge No. 6 in Kansas from 1927 to 1928. Alright, see, we're always movers and shakers. A Freemason gave you basketball. Anyway, that's all for this week. Remember to find us on Facebook at facebook.com/whencecameyou. You can follow us on Twitter at whencecameyou, and you can find us on just about every other social media website as well. We're on Google Plus under the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com. Just a reminder to find the Midnight Freemasons and give them a like, as well as our Far From Centered podcast and Brother Juan Sepulveda's Winding Stairs. Give them all a listen. You won't be sorry. Midnight Freemason pieces come out Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And if you have an article or you want to do an interview on the show, contact me by email at wcypodcast@gmail.com. Again, thanks for listening. I'll chat with you all next week. Stay on the level. The Whence Came You. I'm Robert Johnson.